This is HPR episode 1668 entitled Nixtler. It is hosted by Klaatu and is about 50 minutes long. The summary is, Klaatu talks about Nixtler, packaging applications for GNU Linux and BSD.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and you are listening to Hacker Public Radio. This is an entry in my packaging formats mini-series, except that it's a little bit different because it's not a packaging format that you might expect. It's not an RPM, it's not a deb. Well, because I've already done RPM, but it's not deb either, it's not anything like that. It's different. So, to lead up to what I'm talking about, I'll tell you a little story. Back when Humble Bundle was just kind of starting, I think there had already been one, and then they were coming out with a second one, and I don't remember all the games in that, but I do remember specifically that Penumbra, I think that's what it's called, Penumbra, the sort of horror game, I think, was being released in this second Humble Bundle. And at that point, this was, you know, back in the days before Steam for Linux existed, and so at that point I thought that playing a game on Linux kind of sounded like an interesting novelty. I'd never really thought about doing that. In fact, at that point in my life, to be honest, I hadn't really even thought about playing games on computers. That was just something completely foreign to me. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try this Humble Bundle thing. So I purchased the Humble Bundle, quite a lot, actually. I remember giving handsomely to it. And I went to install certainly Penumbra and possibly some of the other titles, but for at least that one, I remember very specifically that it downloaded as sort of like this, I think it was just penumbra.sh. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to run this script, this shell script, and it will presumably, I guess it's going to download and install the game or something, you know? So I launched this thing, and what it actually does is it starts this little installer, sort of an install wizard, if you will. And I remember thinking that that was quite unexpected because I'd never really seen that on Linux. I mean, sure, I'd gone to an app, to the application center or whatever, and installed, or I had run an install script, Slack build, or whatever, or maybe I'd just dragged something to my /bin directory. All of that was familiar to me. I've even gone so far, probably, as installing or like downloading an RPM or a deb or something and clicking on that and then having it open in the standard system application manager software. All that was familiar, but I'd never really seen like this very, very, certainly on other operating systems, very, very familiar kind of paradigm where you click an icon and it launches this little install wizard which takes you through half a dozen useless agreements and clicking next a bunch of times and then saying okay and then it installs and then you say okay again and the installer goes away finally and then you launch the program and sure enough it's on your system. So I'd never really seen that and I thought it was kind of interesting to see that on Linux and you know, it just kind of registered, that's all. And as I got more Humble Bundles in the future and probably other applications as well, but I can definitely remember them being, you know, popping up here and there among the Humble Bundle offerings. And then most recently I came across it again with this application called Natron, which is a compositing, a graphic compositing, motion picture compositing software from, well, you can look it up, Natron, N-A-T-R-O-N. It's actually a very cool application, but that's beside the point. The point is that this install wizard kept popping up, and I kept thinking, I gotta check this thing out, I gotta look into this. And I just kept forgetting, or I'd put it off, or whatever. So, turns out, I mean, finally, I got curious enough, and I kind of looked further at this application that I kept running into. Turns out it's called Nixtler. Now, this has nothing to do with NixOS, which you may have heard of. I know that GubNew has done at least one HPR episode on that, and I think he's probably talked about it on other shows as well. So I'd heard of NixOS, and there's this sort of thing called Nix, I think Nix packaging, or maybe it's just called Nix, I don't know. But it's that's completely different. This predates all of that, actually. And all this is, this NixStaller, you can find it on nixstaller.sourceforge.net. All it is a shell that does a couple of different things. And it, first of all, it you configure it, and then you launch this little executable script, and it takes what you have given it, and it zips it up, or actually lismas it up, so xz's it up, into a self-contained, distributable archive. And when you unarchive it, it automatically launches this graphical install wizard that takes the user through these clickable screens and helps them install a package. So before I jump into how to use it, let's talk a little bit about how it has developed. Now, I don't know, obviously I have not been following it that long, but I can look back at older releases, and I can read the documentation, and I can kind of see what it was meant to do, and then what it is capable of doing, and both are really, really cool. So I don't know, and if you do know, you can certainly comment or correct me in some way, but it is my impression that old school Unix, or possibly just old school Linux, the idea was that, well, old school would be portable source code, right? You're a developer, you make some application, and you say, I want to send this to a friend of mine. So you send your friend the source code, and the friend takes the source code, compiles it on their computer, and installs it. And that's, you know, it's a matter of configure, make, install, or whatever sequence of install commands you've got. But let's just assume that's it. And maybe you're really nice, and in the make file you include a make uninstall command that then removes all the files that maybe it initially installed. So that was sort of the way of doing it at one point, from what I'm understanding. Certainly it's a possible way of installing things. And then, of course, since computers have not always been quite as fast as they tend to be now, I'm sure at some point people thought, well, it would be kind of neat if I didn't have to keep recompiling this code. I mean, especially if you're managing any number of computers, you really, there's a distinct advantage to being able to compile the thing once and then distribute it to many computers without that step, because it's already compiled for that architecture. And from what I understand, that's kind of how tar archives got used for distribution of software. They figured, okay, well, what we can do is do a make install into a very specific directory, and we'll arbitrarily call this directory destdir. And I mean, obviously you could call it anything you want, but I'm going to call it a destination directory. And so instead of installing it to the root of your file system, it would be installing it into this fake root, you know, sort of a cherooted root almost. It's like this other directory. And if it doesn't find the folders that it needs, it will create the folders, and then it'll copy the compiled files over into this destination directory. And so then what you have is this miniaturized version of a file system, but it's super, super sparse. Like, so sparse that it only contains the stuff that you compiled or otherwise placed into it. So rather than having /usr/etc/lib and so on, it just has like whatever it needs, /usr/ maybe, well, really probably just usr, but maybe /lib, well, no, it would be probably /usr, and then inside of there it would be bin and share and lib or whatever. So you've got, or I guess user local maybe, depending on how you do it. The point being, you're sending all this stuff into this dedicated folder, and then you tar it up, maybe you gzip it, and then you send it to your other computers or your friends or whatever. And all you have to do to install that onto the new computer is tar xf this archive dash capital C slash. And what it does, tar, by design, it looks at the folder that you've sent it to, and it sees that it's slash. So it says, okay, well, slash I have, so I'll skip that one now, /usr. Okay, well, /usr I also have, but it looks like there's some stuff inside of /usr as well, so let me look at that. And it sees the share and the bin and the lib or whatever, and then it decides, okay, well, or maybe usr and then, yeah, bin and then share. And then it says, okay, well, I've got this folder of an icon that I can dump into share, and I've got this executable that I can dump into bin, and it does that, and then the thing is installed. So basically, it's almost, if you can think of it, this is how I think of it, it's an overlay. It's not an overlay, but it's like you're taking this stuff and then just kind of sprinkling it over or overlaying it on top of what already exists. So Nixstaller, from what I can tell, started out with that assumption, that the steps that you were going to take in order to get something installed was that you will have probably compiled the source code yourself, put it into a directory for it, and then all you're doing with Nixstaller is you're tarring it up and including a nice little graphical interface script thing to help users who maybe don't know how to use a terminal or don't want to, it helps them click next and make sure, you know, just kind of verifies, hey, is this the place that you want me to install these files to? They say, yes, it is. And then Nixstaller dumps all the files into the place where the user has told them. That's the idea. The cool thing about Nixstaller is that it can actually be a lot more flexible than that. But we'll look at some of the examples together and see if this is at all useful to you. So, if you want to, you're certainly welcome to go get the Nixstaller 0.5.1 release. Don't be scared that its last release date was like in 2012. It isn't as if this needs to be a fast-moving project. It really doesn't. You can just download Nixstaller-0.5.1 and trust me, it'll work great. So grab that and unzip it or untar it or whatever it is. And when you do that, you'll see that there are quite a few files, you know, in the directory. There are quite a few files, and it's a little bit confusing possibly as to which you need to start with. Now, you can install Nixstaller to your system by doing a make self.sh, I think is the script. I honestly don't know, I've never run it. But yes, you can use Nixstaller to install Nixstaller, which, you know, anytime you can use an application to install itself or to compile itself or whatever, that's pretty cool to me. But yes, that's how you can install it. Now me, I don't install it. I run all the Nixstaller commands from my current location. And that is simply because in my training, as it were, self-training really, but in the way that I learned how to package, I've always done it in a dedicated directory. You know, like Slack builds, I've always had a directory where I keep all my Slack builds and the template files and things like that, just for organization really. And then RPMs, you know, in RPM build, that's kind of the RPM tree is basically forced upon you. So I'm in the habit of doing things that way, so that's how I do it here. I just put, I have a Nixstaller folder, and I have all of my work files in there, and that's how I keep it. So I kind of honestly recommend doing it that way, but it's obviously up to you. You can do whatever you want, but that's how I do it. So the thing that you'll probably want to look at first are the examples. There are some great examples. There are about five different ones, And the first one that you want to look at probably is simple, the simple example, because that's the one that sort of, as I say, it's the most basic setup that you could probably come up with, and that's assuming that you're doing a very traditional kind of Linux install, and it's assuming that you don't need any special intervention in what you're doing. So it's going to use a lot of sort of built-in functions so that you really almost don't have to do anything. So when you're in, go into the example directory if you have it, and if not, you can just follow along in your imagination. And then there's a simple thing. So there are two, the two things that you really want to pay attention to right up front are the config.lua and the run.lua. So Nixtaller uses Lua scripting language, which if you've ever looked for a job in the gaming industry, from what I have understood and what I've seen myself, Lua is kind of a big deal there. But it's also, I believe, it's the scripting language and configuration language, I guess, of choice for, Awesome, I think it is. So, it's pretty popular. And from what I can tell, I mean, this was actually my first real life exposure to it. I mean, I'd heard of it. I'm sure I've seen it before, but I never really had to actually use it. But from what I can tell, it's pretty simple to pick up. So that's kind of nice. So the first one we'll look at, I guess, is config.lua. And I'll just open it up here in Emacs. That's just a plug for Emacs, really. Just wanted to say it. And it's not a terribly long file. It's about 40 lines, this one. And so we can just go through the options. I mean, it's 40 lines, but half of those are comments, and the other half are blank lines. That doesn't make sense. A third of them are comments, and a third of them are blank lines. So the first thing that you'll see that looks like it matters is the config mode, cfg.mode, and it is currently set by default to attended. The options that you have are both attended or unattended. And attended, of course, is the one where it's really interactive versus non-interactive. So attended is interactive, meaning that the user is going to launch this distributed thing that you give people to, so that they can install your application, and they have to launch it and then click through the screens manually. For power users, you can make this either unattended exclusively or attended and unattended, i.e. both, and then they can just launch it from the command line with flags and switches of your choosing, of your definition. So that's a nice option to have. Now, I have not used both or unattended. I've only done this attended, and the reason I've done it is because my use case has been I am distributing applications to people who I do not want them to have to go into the terminal to do this. I want them to be able to just do this graphically. So my use of this has been very specific and fairly limited, but I have read up a lot on it, and at some point I may use the unattended mode, and if you think that's useful, give it a go. Next one is config.appname. That would be whatever application you want this to be. This actually doesn't matter. I thought maybe, okay, this is going to be important. It's going to be useful for parsing and stuff like that. It's not. It appears in some pop-up dialog boxes when the installer, the graphical installer, is telling the user what's happening. It will say things like, "Now installing foo to your hard drive," you know. And if you set foo to anything, that's what'll show up. It won't affect anything. In fact, this whole file is basically, it's a config file. It doesn't figure into the actual processing of the source code that you're distributing. Okay, next one is config.archivetype. Again, I thought when I was first doing this, I thought, okay, well, this, it's going to ask, you know, I need to set this to whatever I'm giving it. And I thought, well, I'm giving it a BZ2, so I need to set this to BZ2. No, this is completely not about the package that you're distributing. This is about the the Nixtaller package that you are building. So this is Lisma. By default, you can choose different types of compression. I don't know why you would. Actually, I do. If you're sending it out to slow computers that you think might take a long time to uncompress a Lisma, you might want to go with something a little bit lighter. But in my experience, Lisma, you know, I mean, yes, it's slower because it compresses more, but it's not really that slow. I mean, it's modern computers. But yeah, use your best judgment. Next one is config.targetOS. Now, this one you can set or you can leave blank. The reason you can leave it blank is because we only have one option in this particular example. This is what I have done, is I've only been doing, you know, I've been doing this for very specific use cases. I know exactly the computers that I am distributing these for, and it's only for local distribution. I'm not posting my packages online anywhere. This is just a convenience kind of thing. So I've been targeting very specifically either NIL or Linux. And if you do define it, then you have to do a curly brace space quote Linux close quote close curly brace. And you know it's Linux because you issue the command uname on the command line, and it tells you what you are running. So if you're on a different system, then you'll want to, or if you're building for a different system, you will want to find out the exact string that is returned from the command uname. So if it's ABSD, then you need to know whether it's going to say BSD or whether it's going to say very specifically FreeBSD or NetBSD, or is it going to say Sun, or is it going to say SunOS, or is it going to say Solaris? So you have to know that. You really do need to find that out if you want this to work. So let's see. The target CPU architecture is obvious, config.targetarch. You can give it any number of architectures that you want to target. And again, you can't make this stuff up. You just have to type in uname-m and find out what the architecture name is. And it turns out it's either x86 or x86_64. Now again, this is going to matter in a later step, both the operating system and the CPU architecture, because there are some folders that we'll need to create out in our project area that correspond to what we are telling it has access to. So if we say the target OS is Linux and FreeBSD, and we say that the target arches are x86 and x86_64, then we're going to need directories for each of those. In other words, we're going to need a Linux_x86, a Linux_x86_64, a FreeBSD_x86, and a FreeBSD_x86_64. Okay, we'll get into that later. It'll all make sense. My point, I guess, is not to just make stuff up, and it's, you know, you want to think about what you're actually targeting and what you can actually test on. Okay, so the front ends to include, this is really cool, cfg.frontends. You've got three to choose from, GTK, FLTK, or incurses. So this means, and this is really, really cool, this means that if someone is running a system without GTK on it, then the GUI interface will fall back to FLTK. And if they don't have FLTK or GTK, which probably means they're not running X at all, then it can still fall back to incurses. So, I mean, this is super powerful. I mean, as long as someone's got a computer of the correct OS, this can present them with a GUI and take them step by step through their install. Very, very cool. Okay, next is config.defaultLanguage. And I've just left that at English because that's, again, my target is very specific. cfg.languages, they have a couple of different languages available. If you do your own translation, you certainly can add that to a folder and add that into the array. cfg.autolang is true. really, again, I mean, it just depends on how you're what you're doing this for. I could leave this false. I think it's just untrue by default, so I leave it untrue. But it doesn't much matter. I mean, I'm not installing on anything but an English language system, so there's no auto detection really happening. And the picture used for the welcome screen is the cfg.intro pic, and the logo is cfg.logo. So the intro pic is a up to 300 by 200, I believe it is, file. It can be a JPEG or PNG, whatever. And it will go into the initial screen of your installer. I have to warn you that it does kind of, it means that your welcome text, if you have any, is pushed over off to the side a little bit. So like the first time I tried this, I mean, it is cool to be able to have this intro pic because you can brand it, you know? And that's I wanted that because the packages that I'm making is for, like, this local makerspace. And I kind of wanted them to see that, hey, this is stuff being made by, like, real people. You know, this is not a corporate, application that's being made by someone you don't know. This is by someone that you know. This is by the makerspace. So I put the logo of the makerspace there. But it pushed the welcome text so far off to the right that it introduced this horizontal scroll bar, and it was a little bit overkill for just a little intro screen. So I made my intro pic the right size, which I think is 300 by 200, and then I just kept the welcome text quite short, and that worked out. But play around with that, I guess, before you go into production or whatever. The logo file is the icon that will get used for the installer. Now, both of these, the intro pic and the logo, no, the logo is the logo up in the top left. The config app icon, that's the icon that gets used. But anyway, all of these, the logo and the icon, the intro pic, not really, that just defaults to nothing. But logo and icon, they have very nice defaults. So if you don't have anything that you want to use, or you can't think of, what you might want to use, don't worry. It looks really nice as is, so you can just leave them blank if you want. Now, if you do define the intro pic and the logo and the app icon, you have to place these files somewhere. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the file structure. So we're in this sample folder, but in real life, what you would have done by now is you would have executed the gin project shell script. So ginproj.sh. You run that and it gives you like this empty kind of template for a Nixstaller, and that includes the config.lua that we just went through. That was the whole of it, and a run.lua, which we'll go through in a minute. And then a couple of different directories that by default exist. There's a files_all, a files_extra, and a lang. And I think maybe a welcome screen, or a welcome text, I don't remember for sure. But those are the directories and files. So the files_all, that's where you put your payload. That's the stuff that you want to install, you put it into files_all, unless you are targeting multiple OSs, and that's where that comes in, the whole config.lua thing where you say, okay, I'm targeting Linux and FreeBSD. Well, if you do that, then you have to have a files_Linux and a files_FreeBSD, and you place your payload for Linux into the files_Linux, and you place your payload for FreeBSD into files_FreeBSD. And once again, if you've got Linux and FreeBSD multiple architectures, let's say you've got x86 and x86_64, then you need to have a files_Linux_x86 and a files_Linux_x86_64, and so on, again, for FreeBSD. So it can get a little bit bulkier in that sense. Honestly, I'm not 100% sure why you would target multiple OS's in the same package. I'm not sure if I would do that myself. I would probably have separate downloads for the Linux and for the FreeBSD versions. But if it's a small application, maybe it's more trouble for you to do that. So it's up to you, obviously. So the files_extra is where you're going to put your intro pic, your logo and your icon if you're customizing those things. As I've said, honestly, the defaults are quite attractive. I would not bother necessarily feeling like you have to put something there. The lang folder just has the string files for the for each language. For, I think, English, Dutch, Bulgarian, Lithuanian, and Polish are the ones that they have by default. So if you want to use that, you're certainly welcome to. I have not needed that yet, so I have not. The config.lua we've just gone through, so let's talk a little bit about this run.lua, because that's really where all the action happens. That's the file that contains the actual instructions for Nixtaller. So there are three functions in a run.lua file. There's a function for init, it's called init, so that's obviously the initial or the initialization function, the thing that runs once when we kick this off. And then there's the function install, and that's, as the name suggests, that's really where it happens. That is the installation of your application. And then there's a function finish as well, which inherits any kind of error. And so finish is going to be either a true or a false thing. If it's true, then it'll do something. If it errors out, then you can have it do something else. I've not used the finish function yet. So this is super simple, and how simple or not simple it is, honestly, it can vary, because it just depends on how you are installing your software. So the first thing we'll do is just look at what I feel is the expected use case, or was the expected use case for Nixtaller. So that would be in init, we would set our destination directory to some place. Now, it's important to note that the destination directory is not actually the destination directory. It's actually just the unzip directory, the untar directory. So in other words, when we start Nixtaller, where do we want our packaged up files? Because remember, a Nixtaller file is really an archive in disguise. So where do we want those to get untarred to? Untarred to. And that, by default, is home, the home directory, which is os.gitonv parent quote home close quote close parent, or bracket, whatever people call it. So that's the default. I don't do that myself, but it is a safe bet, because you know that the user launching the thing can write to their own home directory. I personally use /temp, but you could use home as well. Now the next thing that you need to tell Nixtaller is which screens you want it to use. Now you can custom define screens, but I'm not going to get into that because I haven't done that yet. But by default, I think they give you a welcome screen, a license screen, a select screen, a select dir screen, an install screen, and a finish screen. And I of those, I use the welcome screen, because that's just kind of a nice greeting of, yes, you're here, this is what you're doing, you're about to install this application. I don't use the license screen, I just delete that entry from the list. And then the select dir screen, I don't think I use that one either, to be honest. But you can, and it is a cool one. I've seen it be used before, and it lets the user kind of decide, oh, I want to install into user games or user bin or whatever. So that's kind of neat, but I don't use it because, again, I have a very specific use case, and it's basically I want people to be able to click on a package and click through some confirmation screens and get the thing installed. So install screen and finish screen. Now, it's built into Nixtaller that if the user launching Nixtaller, the installer itself, if they don't have permission to install to a certain directory, then it will prompt them for a password. So that's just kind of a nice thing to inherit. So that's really it for the function init. That's all you have to do. And then the function install again, by default, is install.extractfiles. Okay, so again, that's the most basic. I mean, that's it. That's all. We're done. And that is the most basic version of this scenario you could possibly do. And you're noticing maybe that the command to install was to extract files. So all it's going to do is extract the files that you gave it. And so again, the assumption is that you've given it a self-contained tar of files that you want to dump onto someone's computer. So this is like a really elaborate way by default to untar a directory in a specified location. So that's not actually how I use it, because I mean, I could use it for that. It's just I don't. But you can. You certainly can. You can do other cool things. You can use it to run installation scripts from within Nextdollar. You can use it to compile code and then install. You can even use it to compile code or not. Install and then register the things that you have just installed with the systems package manager. Yes, you heard me correct. You cannot write RPMs, Debs, Slackware packages, and or Arch, I think, Pacman, I think, or something like that, packages, and just have Nextdollar do all your work for you and register it with the user's system so that if they then type in yum remove foo, then you know yum will actually know what foo is. It won't. Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's not going to make a .rpm for you, but the database of the package management database will know that the thing exists, that it was installed, what was installed, and what to remove. So that's really a really cool kind of little bonus trick there that you can do. So here's how I use it, and this is a lot of sort of cheating and things that probably no one ever intended, but it works for me really well. And that is that in my init function I set install.destdir to equal quote slash temp. So I unzip everything to slash temp. Then I give it a list of the screens that I want to run, which are, as I said, welcome screen, install screen, and finish screen. And then I execute in the install function, I execute the install.extractfiles command. So install.extractfiles parent, and that extracts the files by default to the destdir, which is again slash temp. Then I do an os.chdir, so that's os.chdir, and then parent install.destdir close parent. So now I've just changed directory to the install destdir location, which is slash temp. Then I do another oschdir, and I change into the folder that I know that I've already put there. So let's just say that's foo. How do I know it's foo? Well, because I put a folder called foo in files underscore all. So now I'm in my own directory where I have put whatever I need, and then all I do, and this is like, I'm telling you, it's a dirty trick, I'm just cheating, but this is how flexible this thing is. I do an oschmod paren quote doinst.sh close quote comma 700 close paren, so I've just chmodded so that it's executable in my own private installation shell script that I've written separately, separate of Nextdollar. And then I tell it to set status to installing files. I tell it if write permission on slash usr is false, then install.execute as root doinst.sh, and then it prompts the user for a password. And failing that, I just do an install.execute of my doinst.sh. And then I end the function. So I mean, and in my do inst.sh, I can do whatever I want. And that's primarily because some of the things that I'm installing in my very specific use case, they, you know, I'll have like a .deb that I want to install with dpkg, and then I want to install some extra stuff like a desktop application.desktop file, and maybe I want to move something around. You know, I do a lot of sort of system-y types of things that I figure, okay, I'll throw that into the script because I know it needs to get done, and I'm about to run this thing on 12 different computers. So I'm stepping outside of Nixstaller proper and just running an arbitrary shell script. But it's that flexible. You can do that. It will let you do that, which is really, really kind of cool. So let's say that we've finished up all of this stuff. We've placed our payloads into our files underscore all folder. We've placed our pictures and our logos and our icons into files extra. And we've set all of our configuration options. We've created our run.sh. So the next thing, all that's left to do really is to create the actual installable file that you're going to send to people or put on a thumb drive and sneaker net or whatever over to all the computers that you need this thing to be installed on. So that's the gininstall.sh script in the Nixstaller folder. So you run that, just .gininstall.sh, and then the path to the directory that you want it to use as, you know, the source. So it might be a .gininstall.sh foo-1.0.0, and then some name for the installer file itself. I like to name them like foo.install. I think that's fairly descriptive. So it might be foo.install, and then there's another one, bar.install, and so on. You could call it foo.sh, you can call it foo.bin, foo.exe, it doesn't matter, whatever. I mean, exe would be dumb, because then if you have wine, it's going to think that it needs to launch there. But, you know, I mean, the point is, you can call it whatever you want. Foo.run, you've seen that before, probably. .run, that's a pretty good one. So, anyway, gininstall does a little bit of a dummy check, make sure that it parses all your files. If it finds any kind of obvious syntactical errors in your Lua, it will tell you. And assuming it does not, it will then archive up your files, and it places, you know, the different parts of it in different places. I'm assuming it takes your actual executable script, your settings, and it probably parses it into its default script, places that at the head of the archive, and then the archive itself probably gets placed somewhere after that, and that's placed into your current directory or wherever you've specified, and now you've got this foo.install or foo.run or whatever you've named it. Now that will be a fairly large file. I mean, it's an archive. It's lismud up, so it's not as large as it could be, but you know, it's got all the files that you're redistributing in it. And so you could put that on a thumb drive, or you can put it on a server somewhere, or whatever you need to do. Send it out to people, and now if they double-click on it, or click on it, however they've got their file manager configured, it will, you know, invisibly, essentially, unzip itself, unarchive itself, and present them with a graphical installer that they can then click next, next, yes, next, okay, install, whatever. And it's really cool. It looks nice. It looks very familiar. It's friendly. People are used to that kind of workflow. I like it a lot. It's pretty slick. And again, it's super flexible. You can run scripts of your own choosing, really. As long as you've included it in the archive, you can do whatever you want. Like I say, you can also register it with the person's system, the user's system application manager, given that it's either an RPM, a .deb, a Slackware, or I think, like, Pacman. I'm pretty sure that's the other one. But, I mean, it's got, like, four different formats that it will report about, you know? I mean, it's quite nice. It is really, really slick. So, And I've not even used, I haven't used that feature. I haven't used half the features of this thing, really. I've just used it because I wanted a friendly front end for an installer that I basically just wrote in a shell script myself. And it's just so nice. You should really, really try this if you're packaging stuff up and you need it to be across distributions, or you just don't want to take the time to learn RPM or Slackware packaging, Slack builds, or ports or whatever. This is a very nice solution. It looks good. It's familiar to your user. It's really nice. So, I mean, heck, even if you don't intend to use it for production, it is worth checking out. Just download the thing and take a look at it. It's quite nice. It's quite interesting. And it's fancy. It's neat. And it's easy to use. I mean, as I've described, it comes with many examples, so you can kind of look through the different run.luas and see kind of what they do. They have BZ flag, cube unattended, and vim, and a simple example. So it's like five different things that you can look at. And then they've got great documentation as well. If you look on their nextstaller.sourceforge.net, if you read through that thing, it really does explain everything that you need to know. So that's everything that I can think about in terms of Nextstaller. So I hope that's helpful and useful to you. It certainly has been quite useful to me. It's quite a nice application, so please do try it out. And thank you very much for listening.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.